Lecture 11, Energy, Resources and Alternatives.
Lecture 11, Energy, Resources and Alternatives. We've seen that humankind's energy use is the predominant reason for our influence on Earth's climate through the combustion of fossil fuels and the production of greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide. So if we're going to do something about human alteration of climate, if we're going to slow that or stop that process, we need to do something that keeps the carbon dioxide generated from fossil fuels out of the atmosphere. I'll talk about some alternatives that might still involve fossil fuels in the next lecture. But for now, the most obvious thing we could think of doing is replacing fossil energy sources with other sources of energy. So this lecture is a survey of some of the other energy sources available to us. And I want to take a realistic view of those sources, something I think doesn't always happen. I want to look at particular energy sources and see whether there is really enough there to supply that colossal energy consumption that I described in the previous lecture. And also to ask whether we have the technological and economic means to extract energy from some of the other sources that are available to us. So the question is, what are some of those other sources? Well, I want to get very fundamental about that, and I want to take a look at Earth's energy resources. So let's look at a diagram that depicts the flows and fuels that make up Earth's energy resources. Once again, flows are streams of energy that come to Earth and flow around through the Earth system, and we can tap into those streams of energy. Fuels are substances that store energy, materials that have energy locked into their chemical or nuclear structure, and we can extract that energy. So let's look at these fuels and flows. What are Earth's actual energy resources? So the diagram I'm showing you has a huge arrow coming in at the upper left. That's the solar flow, the flow of solar energy to planet Earth. And that flow constitutes 99.98% of all the energy arriving at the Earth system. That's a big number. Solar energy supplies virtually all the energy that comes to planet Earth. So when we talk about our energy resources, at least energy flows, these streams of energy that we can tap, the dominant energy flow to planet Earth is solar energy. Remember that when someone tells you there isn't much solar energy and solar energy isn't a viable alternative. The rate at which solar energy reaches Earth from the sun is a little bit more than 10,000 times that 15 trillion watt energy consumption rate of humankind, of civilized humanity. That's 10,000 times more energy than we human beings use is coming to the Earth from the sun in any given time. The solar flow is huge. It's 10,000 times humankind's energy consumption, and it is the vast majority of the energy that comes to the Earth system, 99.98% of it. And this diagram I'm showing you talks about those flows in terms of percentages of the total amount of energy coming to Earth. So the solar flow is 99.98% of the energy coming to the Earth system. We found already that about 31% of the solar energy is reflected directly off the Earth, off the clouds, off ice caps, off snow, off deserts, and so on. And so 69% of the energy coming to Earth is solar energy that actually gets into the Earth system without being reflected off. What does that energy do? Well, it drives a number of subsidiary flows. For example, 45% of that solar energy that comes into the Earth atmosphere system gets converted into thermal energy, the energy of warmed things, mostly the surface of the Earth, but also to some extent the atmosphere. Some of that energy, about 23%, goes into evaporating water from the ocean and other surface waters, and that energy gets stored temporarily in the atmosphere in the form of water vapor. I talked about that before, how water in the vaporous state contains this latent heat, this latent energy associated with the fact that it's been converted from a liquid to a gas, and we could get that energy back if we recondensed it into a liquid, or nature can get that energy back if nature recondenses it into a liquid. About 1% of the incoming solar energy ends up driving the winds and the ocean currents. Only about 1%, but that's still 100 times humanity's energy consumption goes into driving winds and ocean currents, making the movements of air and water that constitute those currents. Very tiny fraction of the incident solar energy, about 0.08%, 0.08 of a percent, almost a tenth of a percent, almost one part in a thousand, but not quite, is the energy that's captured by living plants, by green plants, through the process of photosynthesis. And that energy flows from the plants into dead material. When the plants die, it flows through the animals because all animals are dependent ultimately on plants for the source of their energy. and it flows out of the life system through the decay of dead matter and waste matter. A tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of that energy that's been captured by plants, as I described earlier, is stored underground as the fossil fuels. And in today's world, there is also a flow of energy out of the fossil fuels. That's the 7 gigatons per year of carbon, an equivalent amount of energy you could calculate. It's about 0.007% of the entire Earth energy flow that comes out of the ground right now as fossil fuels are consumed and burned to human uses. There's a very small fraction of energy, about 0.0005% of the total energy flow, that is being extracted from the ground in the form of nuclear fuels and also driving human activities. There are a couple of other flows that we ought to talk about, too. They're very small compared to the solar flow because the solar flow constitutes 99.98% of all the energy coming to Earth, but they are important. One is the geothermal flow. The geothermal flow is about 0.025% of all the energy coming from Earth. These are round numbers, so they don't add up perfectly, but they're close. The geothermal flow, about 0.025% of all the energy coming to the surface of the Earth, is coming from Earth's interior. And this is energy that has two ultimate sources, and geologists aren't absolutely sure how much is one source and how much is the other. But the two sources are the primordial energy that existed when the Earth first formed 4.6 billion years ago by the accretion of smaller bodies in the solar system that crashed together under the influence of gravity, heating up and giving the Earth its primordial heat. Some of that material included radioactive elements like uranium and thorium. Those elements, when they decay, produce heat. And some of that heat is coming from the decay of radioactive elements in the Earth's interior. So that's what keeps the Earth's interior warm. And that drives a very, very modest flow of energy to the surface, far smaller than the rate at which solar energy is coming in, a very small fraction. But that energy is significant, has some important effects on the planet. For example, it's ultimately what drives continental drift, which is a major process in reshaping the surface of the Earth, and as we've seen, also may have an influence on climate. Finally, and it also drives volcanism and processes like that that are also important in climate. Finally, a very, very, very tiny fraction of all the energy, 0.0017% of the energy getting to the surface of planet Earth, is coming from the mechanical energy associated with the rotation of the Earth and the revolution of the moon around the Earth, from the Earth-Moon system, mechanical energy of the Earth-Moon system. And what that mechanical energy does is drive the tides, sloshing the waters of the ocean back and forth, in most places giving us 2 high tides and 2 low tides a day. That energy is also available to us to harness, and that energy has a third distinct source, namely the mechanical energy of the Earth-Moon system. But it's a very, very, very tiny fraction of the overall flow. So let me summarize that in case you came into this course or this lecture thinking, gee, there are all kinds of energy sources out there that we human beings can exploit. Let's just try exploiting different ones. Well, the answer is not quite so simple. There are really only 3 sources of energy to planet Earth, ultimately. One are the solar flow, energy coming from the sun. One is energy coming from within the Earth. That includes this geothermal heat, and it also includes energy stored as fuels inside the Earth, some of which are fossil fuels, which ultimately came from sunlight, and some of which are nuclear fuels, which were built into the nuclear structure of the materials from which the Earth formed. And finally, we have the tidal flow. So that's it. There are really 3 fundamental sources of energy for us to use. And we want to talk about those in realistic terms, about how we might use those to replace the fossil fuels that produce the carbon dioxide that is largely but not entirely responsible for human-caused global warming. So let's take a look at some of these fuels. We know, or some of these flows also, we know in many cases how to tap into the full flows or how to take the fuels and convert that trapped energy into energy we would like to use for transportation, for heating, for industrial processes, for generating electricity, for refrigeration, for cooling, for all the things we do with energy. In some cases, we have the technologies for doing that. In some cases, the technologies are very mature and economical, and in other cases, the technologies are developed, but they aren't developed to become economically viable yet, and in other cases, we simply don't yet have the technologies. Furthermore, some of those sources are more than adequate to supply our energy needs, and some are not. So let's begin by looking in a little more detail at the source of energy we now use to supply most, that is about 87% of the world's energy needs, and that, of course, is the fossil fuels. Well, we know how to get energy from fossil fuels. We burn them. When we burn them, we combine the carbon in the fuels with oxygen to make carbon dioxide, and we combine the water in the hydrogen in the fuels with oxygen to make water. So CO2 and H2O are the products of fossil fuel combustion. By the way, how much we get of each depends on the fossil fuel. Natural gas, CH4, methane, has got more hydrogens than carbons, so more water forms in burning methane and less carbon dioxide. Coal, in contrast, is mostly carbon and so forms mostly carbon dioxide, and oil is somewhere in between. That's why on a per unit of energy generated basis, natural gas is a better fuel in terms of its climate impact than is coal. Coal is the worst in that term. And here I want to make a distinction that I think is often muddied. People talk about coal as a dirty fuel. Coal is a dirty fuel. It produces a lot of other pollutants, mercury, sulfur, other compounds that come out in the burning of coal are pollutants in the traditional sense of being toxic materials that are harmful to us or the environment. But coal also produces more carbon dioxide than the other fossil fuels per unit of energy produced, and I don't want to call that dirtiness, because when we burn a fossil fuel, what we want to do is to create carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is not an incidental byproduct that we could remove, that we could avoid, like sulfur is from coal, or mercury. Those are things that happen to be in the coal that we could either remove or trap after burning. But carbon dioxide is the essential thing we want to make when we burn coal or other fossil fuels. So in that sense, it isn't a pollutant in the usual sense. It isn't a harmful byproduct that doesn't really have to be there, like a toxic contaminant. It's the thing you want to make when you burn a fossil fuel. So keep that distinction in mind when somebody says, well, one fuel is dirty and one fuel is clean. Well, are we talking in a climate sense or are we talking in a pollution sense? Sometimes those two things go hand in hand, but sometimes they don't. So how do we generate energy from fossil fuels? Well, we burn them and we produce carbon dioxide and water vapor, as I've said. How well do we do that? Well, large-scale electric power plants, which are one of the primary uses of fossil fuels, particularly coal, but also increasingly natural gas. Not much oil is used in that place. Large-scale electric power plants, traditional ones, are only about 40% efficient. That is, for every unit of energy in the fuel, only about 0.4 units of energy come out as electricity. What happens to the other 60%? Well, it's usually discarded to the environment as waste heat. And that can be a problem in itself. That's called thermal pollution. Think about that again. We have a huge amount of coal we're going to burn. It contains a lot of energy, and we throw away about two-thirds of the energy, about 60% or more of the energy that was in that coal. We literally throw it away. We typically throw it into a river. If it was going to harm the river too much by raising its temperature, we typically run it through those huge cooling towers, which you may associate with nuclear power, but are just as much needed for coal-burning power plants. We cool down that water before we discharge it to the river. And that water contains most of the energy that was in the coal. What a waste. By the way, that waste is not just the result of poor engineering. It's also a result of a fundamental law of physics, the second law of thermodynamics. And if you've taken my course, Physics in Your Life, I have a discussion there of the second law of thermodynamics and how it poses severe limitations on our ability to extract energy by any process that involves heat, combustion of fossil fuels, fissioning of uranium, whatever. There are more advanced fossil technologies that are called combined cycle power systems. And these combined cycle power systems use a device like a jet aircraft engine, which in itself is a rather inefficient device for converting heat to mechanical energy. But they take the waste heat that comes out of the basically jet aircraft engine, it's called a gas turbine, and they use that to run a conventional steam turbine. And that combination results in efficiencies as high as about 60%. Combined cycle power plants, they're called. So we're still throwing away about 40% of the energy. You can do still better, and that's to do something called cogeneration, in which you have a power plant that generates electricity in the context of a situation, maybe a community that needs heat, maybe an industry that needs steam for some industrial process, and you use what would otherwise be waste heat for these processes that require heat but not necessarily electricity. That's called cogeneration, and that's an even more efficient thing to do. There are whole cities in Europe that are heated with the waste heat from power plants, and so there you're extracting the energy and putting it to good use, and the power plant is therefore much more efficient in using the energy stored in the fuel. Another major use, of course, of fossil fuels is in powering most of our transportation vehicles. Nearly all our transportation, with the exception of electric trains and a few nuclear-powered ships, is powered by fossil fuel fossil fuels. Another exception would be vehicles powered by biomass, for example. But the vast majority of the world's fleet of vehicles are powered by fossil fuels. And they're only about 15% efficient at converting the energy stored in the fossil fuels to the mechanical energy of the wheels of the car. Now, this sounds dismal, but it's also a reason for hope, because it means we could do a lot better in using fossil fuels efficiently. Let me mention one other thing about fossil fuels. All the fossil fuels are in limited supply. For coal, well, maybe not so much for coal. Coal, we have enough coal to last a number of centuries. But the remaining reserves of oil, and there's a lot of debate about this, and I don't think the debate has been resolved clearly. There are a lot of debate, but the remaining reserves of oil and probably of natural gas also are most likely measured in decades, not centuries. And you can quibble about when we will reach the peak of oil people talk about, but there will come a time when the oil production in the world peaks and begins an inexorable decline. And if the demand for oil is continuing to rise, we will have a real energy crisis then. Not when we run out of oil, not when we pump the last drop from the ground, but when that peak occurs. That peaking occurred for the United States in the early 1970s. Demand continued to rise, and we made up that demand by importing oil from elsewhere. That's why the United States imports such a huge amount of oil every day. If we were the whole world, though, there is no other place to import it from. And I don't frankly know whether we're going to have a crisis over the peaking of oil or not. There are some people who are sure that crisis is imminent. There are others who would argue we will slide away from that crisis by switching to alternative sources of energy, both within the fossil realm and outside the fossil realm, and we'll never confront that crisis. Most people would argue we will not confront that crisis for coal because we will never be able to burn all the coal in the ground because of the effect on the climate will be too great. So that's fossil fuels. They cause regular pollution, they cause climate change, and they are in limited supply. I mentioned the geothermal and tidal energy flows. We can, in some limited places around the Earth, extract significant amounts of energy from the ground, particularly in areas that are geothermally active, which unfortunately also tend to be among our scenic areas. Imagine tapping into Yellowstone National Park, for example. We can supply a significant amount of energy in those localized regions. There are some issues. There are pollution issues. There are groundwater depletion issues. There is land subsidence. These are not ideal energy sources. And they are limited in the regions where we can use them, and they cannot ever make a major contribution to the Earth's energy supply. An exception would be if we learned to dig very, very, very deep into the hot rocks, very, very far down, and extract energy from them. Those hot rocks underlie the entire planet, but they're very hard to get to technologically, and I doubt that that's going to be a viable energy source in any reasonable time. And even then, the overall flow of geothermal energy is still small. It may be larger than what we human beings use, but not much larger. So it's not really going to help us out all that much. So geothermal power, in my mind, although it may be the answer in a few localized places, is simply not the answer or a viable answer. Nuclear fuels are another story. Today, nuclear energy supplies about 6% of the world's energy, and as we saw, about 8% of the United States' energy. And of the two non-fossil energy sources that are in widespread use, it's one of two where the technology is developed, established, we know how to make it work, we can argue about whether it's economical, we can argue about whether it's environmentally sound, but we do know how to make energy from nuclear fuels, at least in one of two possible ways. If you look at the energy that's stored in the atomic nucleus, you will find that very light nuclei, like hydrogen and helium, don't have a lot of energy stored in them, It didn't take a lot of energy to make those nuclei. Very heavy nuclei, like uranium, also took less energy to make than the intermediate nuclei, like iron, for example. Iron is the most tightly bound nucleus. In the making of iron, a huge amount of energy was released. And what this means is, if you take a heavy nucleus like uranium and split it in half, you will release energy in producing elements that weigh sort of more middle range like iron. Similarly, if you take lightweight nuclei like hydrogen and fuse them together, you will release a lot of energy as you produce heavier nuclei. That process is called fusion. The former process is called fission. We know technologically how to harness fission to generate energy, particularly to make electricity, and that's where that 6% of the energy from nuclear sources is coming from. We do not know yet how to make fusion energy do anything useful for us except blow things up with nuclear thermonuclear weapons. we do know how to make it work there. Nuclear fusion, by the way, is what powers the sun, and so that's the ultimate source of most of the energy that comes to Earth. But we do know how to make nuclear fission work, and there are some 400 nuclear fission power plants worldwide. They produce highly radioactive waste, and a lot of people are focused on that problem, and it is a problem. On the other hand, a large nuclear power plant, in a course of a year, if you convinced it, compacted its waste, that waste would probably fit under the table I'm speaking in front of, whereas a coal-burning power plant of comparable size to a large nuclear plant produces 1,000 tons per hour of carbon dioxide, 1,000 tons per hour. And that's indicative of a difference between nuclear energy and chemical energy, the kind of energy in fossil fuels. It's a difference of a factor of about 10 million in the concentration of energy. And that's both the great thing about nuclear energy, and it's also the danger of nuclear energy. This very highly concentrated energy allows a nuclear power plant to be refueled once every year or so with a couple truckloads of uranium, while a fossil-fueled power plant is refueled several times a week with 110-car trainloads of coal that are coming from, in the United States, places like Wyoming where they're being strip mined, or places like West Virginia where the whole tops are being removed from mountains to get at this coal. There's a lot of anxiety over nuclear power. I personally think some of that anxiety is a little bit displaced, but my biggest worry about nuclear power is its connection to nuclear weapons and the possibility that any society or group that has access to nuclear power technology, it isn't the same as nuclear weapons technology, but they have some of the expertise to make weapons. I personally believe nuclear power is a lot less harmful for the environment than burning fossil fuels, particularly coal to make electricity versus nuclear fission. But all bets on that opinion would be off if we were ever to have a nuclear war that resulted from nuclear power giving people the wherewithal to build nuclear weapons. So I think nuclear energy, although it could replace some of our fossil fuels, has some problems we need to think about. And in particular, nuclear fission cannot, at least at present, nuclear power in general cannot at present replace our transportation fuels. Maybe in a future with hydrogen fuel cell cars, we can make hydrogen from nuclear energy, but not yet. Nuclear fusion is a different story. We don't know how to make nuclear fusion work, as I said, except in thermonuclear weapons. We're working on the problem. We've been working on the problem since the 1950s. We keep saying it's a few decades off. It keeps being a few decades off. We're now making some real progress. I don't have time here to go into the details of the fusion technology, but let me simply say that if we got nuclear fusion to work, then every gallon of seawater, the special isotope deuterium of hydrogen in every gallon of seawater, would be enough to make a gallon of seawater the energy equivalent of 300 gallons of gasoline. So nuclear fusion, if we ever get it going, has considerable promise. It may end up being too expensive. It does produce some nuclear waste, not nearly as much as our nuclear fission plants produce and not nearly as long-lived. So it's a real possibility, but I think for a very distant future. And if we have a climate change problem, we've got to solve that problem long before that distant fusion future. What about solar energy? Well, I've argued that the solar flow is more than 10,000 times the energy humanity now uses. We have simple passive solar technologies like houses that have a lot of south-facing glass and not much north-facing glass and lots of insulation that can get a significant fraction of their residential heating and lighting energy from the sun. More complex active solar technologies do things like circulate water through simple thermal solar collectors and supply domestic hot water. In cloudy Vermont, where I live, I get 95% of my hot water from May to October from a solar domestic hot water system built into the roof of my garage. Another thing you can do with solar energy is concentrate it with a mirror-like device, boil water or some other fluid, and drive a conventional turbine or some other kind of engine and generate electricity that way. Perhaps the most exciting and promising solar application is photovoltaic devices. These are semiconductor devices that use silicon technology to convert sunlight energy directly into electricity with efficiencies that are typically around 15%, but could get as high as about 40%. They can be done as rooftop applications on individual homes or buildings, or in grid-connected power plants, up to some tens of megawatts or so, not a huge amount of power, but significant. It's spread out in either sunny regions or not such sunny regions, and nevertheless, they will convert sunlight directly into electricity. Solar photovoltaics and most forms of solar energy are not at this point economically competitive with other energy sources. That's partly because of our tax structure and some of the incentives we give still to fossil fuels, but it's also because we simply haven't developed those technologies enough. Nevertheless, solar photovoltaic installations are currently growing worldwide at about 40% a year. There are also indirect solar applications. Hydropower is indirect solar energy that we use to evaporate water. Wind, as I mentioned, about 1% of the incoming sunlight goes into driving the winds. When we harness wind energy with wind turbines, we're tapping into that flow. And finally, biomass, the growing of crops or trees or burning of wood or whatever living materials capture sunlight. They're not very efficient at it. They're only 1% or so efficient, but they grow all over the planet. And if we harvest that, we end up being able to burn it. For instance, we have wood-fired electric power plants that have huge piles of wood chips around them, and the power plant burns those wood chips and operates like a fossil-fueled plant. In fact, some plants can switch back and forth between the two. We're working on biofuels to generate gasoline-like substances that we can burn in our cars. Ethanol, particularly, is used in the United States to supplement gasoline. The way we produce it in the United States is not particularly efficient. It takes almost as much energy, sometimes more, to produce it. But Brazil, with its tropical climate, grows a lot of sugarcane, converts it to ethanol, and uses that to power much of its vehicle fleet. So biomass offers considerable promise. And biomass, although it's being burned and producing carbon dioxide, if it's harvested sustainably and without a lot of fossil fuel involved in processing it, it can become almost carbon neutral, meaning the trees you replant after you cut them down, or the corn you replant after you cut the corn down, or the sugarcane or whatever, then takes as much carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as was put in by burning the previous crop. So combustion of biomass does not need to be a net carbon source. I haven't mentioned one of the favorites of alternative energy people, and that is hydrogen. What about hydrogen? Hydrogen is an ideal fuel in many ways. It burns very cleanly. It produces only water vapor, which is a greenhouse gas, but not to the extent carbon dioxide is from burning fossil fuels. It doesn't produce other pollutants, but here's the rub. There is no hydrogen energy on Earth. Hydrogen has to be in the form of molecular hydrogen, H2, and all the hydrogen on Earth is already, quote, burned. It's mostly tied up in water and other compounds that are basically burned. So there is no hydrogen fuel. Hydrogen is not an energy source for us in the sense that other fuels are. It's an energy carrier. It's something we could make with other energy sources. We can use other energy sources to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. Then we can recombine them by burning or by using fuel cells, devices that combine them and convert the energy directly to electricity. There are many things we could do if we had hydrogen. But we don't have any hydrogen, and we have to make it. And so the climate impact and the environmental impact of hydrogen is the same as the environmental impact of however we make the hydrogen. If we choose to run a coal-fired power plant and use the electricity from that power plant to make hydrogen, then we haven't done any better, and because of inefficiencies, we've probably done a little worse than if we had used the coal-produced energy directly. If we choose to make hydrogen with a nuclear fission reactor, then tied up in that hydrogen are all the environmental problems that are associated with nuclear fission reactors, for example. If we could perfect fusion and use fusion reactors to generate electricity or use their heat directly to split hydrogen, either way splitting hydrogen from water, then we might have an interesting source of hydrogen that would be fairly benign. Or, better yet, if we could find a way to take sunlight and directly break up water, which there are ways to do, it's called photolysis, not a very efficient or economical process, then we could make hydrogen directly from sunlight energy. Or we could build photovoltaic power systems, use the electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and we'd have hydrogen. Hydrogen would be a great energy carrier in some future economy. It's going to be a long time coming. It's not going to come soon enough to solve our greenhouse warming problems. And we have to remember there isn't any hydrogen fuel available to us. We have to make it, and we have to make it in a benign way. Well, finally, let me end by reminding you something else about all these energy sources. Although many of them are better in terms of pollution and climate impact than the fossil fuels, no energy source is perfectly benign. No energy source is perfectly benign. And I want to show you at the end of this lecture a graph that looks at greenhouse emissions from different energy alternatives and scales them relative to each other. For the fossil fuels, we're pretty sure we have a good handle on that. And so I'm showing you for the fossil fuels low and high values of actual technologies in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide emitted in grams per kilowatt hour of energy coming out of these fossil fuels. The worst is coal. The next is oil. The next is natural gas. Those are the fossil fuels. We expect that the fossil fuels are bad in terms of producing carbon dioxide, if I can call that a bad thing. And I think I can, because we're worried about global climate change caused by that carbon dioxide. But next comes solar photovoltaics. They're much harder to estimate, but the energy used in making the silicon, the high purity silicon that's used in making semiconductors, consumes a lot of fossil fuel. So the high estimate for photovoltaic energy is that it is a significant fraction of the carbon dioxide produced from natural gas because of the fossil fuels used in its manufacture. Most of us would argue that it's actually a lot lower, and the low estimate is very small, and as we develop new photovoltaic technologies, that number will go down. Hydroelectricity in the temperate zone can be very, very free of greenhouse emissions, but in the tropics, it can produce large amounts of greenhouse emission, as I mentioned, from the methane that's being burned. Biomass can be done either sustainably or not so sustainably, processed with a lot of fossil fuels or not, and may or may not be greenhouse neutral, and nuclear may produce some greenhouse emission, largely from the processing of nuclear fuels and the building of concrete to make reactors. No energy source is benign, but all the energy sources other than fossil fuels are a lot better, at least from a climate standpoint.